You guys are good?
Yeah, great.
Okay, terrific. Hey, everyone, and welcome to My Damn Services. My Damn Services is a full-service production and consulting company that helps utilize artificial intelligence to develop and manage synthetic media for you and your business. My name is Frank DiCarlo, and Henrik and I are welcoming Nathan Phillips. Nathan, thanks so much for making time today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have you.
Good to chat. Yeah.
And I want to say that I think the work that you do at VAT, acronym Technology, Humans, and Taste, is terrific. Anxious to learn more about that today.
Yeah, happy to talk about it.
Great. This is My Damn Services' third webinar within this synthetic media webinar series. If you missed the first two, you can find them on YouTube and our different social media platforms. Please check those out. We first spoke with Alex Radug. He and his Emmy award-winning voice cloning team are doing incredible work. And our last webinar with Timur Cardam and Oliver Feldwick, we spoke a bit more in depth about integrating synthetic media into existing advertising and marketing workflows and processes. So please feel free to check those out. But today the three of us are going to talk about just some of the many advantages of synthetic media and how it's being used to produce convincing and highly realistic images, videos, and audio in a number of different ways and for a number of different intentions. We'll be saving time at the end for questions and answers. So please feel free to use the Q&A icon by just clicking on that. Enter your questions at any point during the webinar, and we'll make sure that we save some time at the end to get to all of them. Anxious to get started. But before we do, I just want to mention that Henrik DeGeer, the co-founder of My Damn Services, you just finished and published a brand new book, Synthetic Media, The Next Reality. And if I may, absolutely. And if I may, you do an incredible job sharing the conversations and experiences of how companies are struggling with content creation and how they're now producing content at a much larger scale through everything synthetic media has to offer. So congrats on that, Henrik. Nice job.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Let's get into it. But as a reminder, in this series, Henrik and I will be inviting other speakers and inviting them to talk on relevant topics and latest AI advancements that bring beneficial synthetic media strategies. It's our intention to explore how much of the artificial intelligence is positively influencing synthetic media. At the same time, accelerating much of the creative processes with more possibilities and scale. So I'm going to get us in conversation mode. And Henrik, you maybe want to kick us off? Well, I know we're anxious to speak with Nathan today and get his insights.
Definitely. Nathan, thanks so much for making the time again. Let's kick off with a question around why are we using synthetic media? Why should we?
I think it's a really good question. And the why question is a big motivator for me. I think a lot of time with new technology, we start with the how, and we, you know, we're all convinced we know how it works. And we speed right through that. Like, why in the world would we ever do any of those things? So my kind of objective, whether I'm speaking on something or writing or making work, is always to focus on the why and then figure out the right technology to do it. I think, you know, when we think about these black rectangles we carry around, or the black rectangle from which I'm seeing you, or I have another black rectangle here, which is an iPad mini, all of these shiny black rectangles do the same thing. They're everything machines. And synthetic media is kind of an output of an everything machine, right? So as we approach the incredible capabilities of being able to create alternate realities that ultimately don't have any indicators that they aren't real, that why part is just so immensely gigantic. And I have a quick little presentation. And I think probably a lot of people in my position have some presentation they do about the campfire, the first story that was ever told. But this is my take, and I think it ladders up to kind of the why of synthetic media. So permit me, if you will, to share some visuals here. You see a woman sitting in a white space. Okay, she's a cave person. A long time ago, she was messing around, playing with some rocks. One rock hit the other rock, and something happened, which is called fire. And she accidentally, like all great innovations, accidentally discovered this fire. Now, fire does a lot of things, but fire at its base is really a rudimentary social network, right? Because we're drawn to it. We see magic in it. It makes us feel good. It brings people together. And so needless to say, there was another cave person walking down the street, saw the fire, was drawn to it because everybody loves a social network, and did what people do when they see a campfire, which is started telling a story. Now, this guy had kind of had a little bit of a different experience than this woman, as is the case with all humans. So they had different information. And as he was telling the story of where he came from and what he believed and what he thought, he was talking about what was above them. And she hadn't spent much time looking up because she was a very much looking down person, which is how she discovered fire. But he said, you know what those are called? those little dots, she says, those are stars. And those are actually the spirits of people that used to be alive. And that moon, the big one, that's God. And they're in charge. And she's like, wow, that is completely amazing. And in that moment was codified our relationship to story for the next many, many thousands of years, which is that a story is something that is told to you by somebody who knows it. And that story is always in the past tense, once upon a time, dot, dot, dot. And it's often about gods and heroes, right? The most important kind of most exciting individuals become the protagonists until this thing happens. The Gutenberg Press, a little while later. Gutenberg Press is really interesting because it's the opposite of a social network, right? It's actually a content creation tool. And what it did is it changed the nature of story as we understand it. So stories were something that you listened to or something that you told if you knew it. But the Gutenberg Press puts the books in the hands of everybody. So it takes this story, let's say it's like the biblical story, which is obviously the first and most popular thing that was printed on that thing. And it took it out of the hands of the clergy and the wealthy, and it put it in the hands of people at home. And they could skip pages and be like, you know what? I'm actually going to change the gender of this character, or I'm going to riff on this because I now hold the story. So story is no longer something you listen to. Story is something you can tell, and anybody can tell it. And that fractures reality as we know it, because we used to listen to stories, but now we actually are partaking in it, right? We have power over story, and that starts to change stuff. And it opens the door to synthetic media, because in some ways, a book activates your imagination as the first synthetic media platform, because it can facilitate thoughts that you weren't able to have on your own and start changing the way you think about reality. And then it's the early 90s, right? Gutenberg Press, you got radio, you got TV, you got all these things where people are telling stories, where they're owning stories. And then this woman named Mary Ellis Bunham in the early 90s is trying to make a show for MTV, but the budget's just not working out. And she's like, you know what? These actors are so damn expensive. Why don't we just find the people? Wow, find the people. So it's not a fictional character now, right? So in the lens of synthetic media, we're now talking about literally shifting our understanding of reality, because she's taking real people off the street and putting them inside of a media box. And it's like, that changes everything, because when The Real World comes out, I could be sitting at home watching The Real World in New York City. I'm bored and I'm like, you know what? I'm gonna go to a bar, see somebody at the bar. I'm like, hey, you're attractive. I'm attractive to you. One thing leads to another. We go home together, right? And I go, there's cameras. That was weird, right? Wake up the next morning and leave. That night, I see myself in The Real World. And I'm looking at myself in The Real World. And is that me? Or am I me? Am I the audience? Or am I the like person sitting at the campfire? Am I the person telling the story at the campfire? Am I God? Am I the star? Like, where does the me of fiction and the me of reality begin and end? And ultimately, we end up here, where that campfire paradigm has completely shifted, where now if I were to say, is your Instagram self your real self? You would say, no, of course not. It's curated. And I go, cool, where do I meet your real self? And the answer is like, I don't know, like the shower, like sleeping, like there's no answer. Where it's easier for us to articulate our artificial or fictional selves than it is for us to talk about the real ones. And we are starting to shift into a world where that synthesized application of media, those realities we're creating, are actually more powerful than the ones we live in. And I'll give you two examples that prove this hypothesis. One is Borat. Borat, I think, changed the way we think about not just reality and culture and films and comedy, but our entire place in the media ecosystem, because all Borat did was pretend that he was real. And when he pretended that he was real, he exposed reality for what it really is. And he used a synthetic media of sorts, in the sense that it was, his medium was himself. And he showed us this reality that was totally hidden to us. He showed us our real selves. And the implications of that are incredibly powerful, especially when you think about it through the lens of politics. Somebody who went into reality television and gained all these superpowers and then went out into reality, and they stayed, right? That stuff was born out of a fictional television program, and then it became real. And here we are in a place where reality and fiction are super blurred. And so my answer to, like, why do we use synthetic media, I think, is because we want the opportunity to meet our real selves. Like, making fictional stuff has become actually easier than living in reality. So we need to start thinking about how synthetic media and digital capabilities can start to improve our real life and make the selves that we experience in reality actually increase in value and perspective. So it's about shifting perspective, I think, and giving you a new way to look at reality.
Awesome.
That's powerful.
It is. I like how you went down to the Stone Age to now and the future. so you already touched on this.
Is not just about the future. Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
No, continue your thought.
I was just saying that, like, media, we often think about all of this stuff as new, but it didn't start when Steve Jobs made a presentation, lo those many years ago. The media has always been there. It's just the media buy has become a lot more expensive and plugged into electricity. But I think when you think about the why, we don't have to start now. You can back up and say, like, why did that person tell that person that story at the campfire? And the answer is generally somewhere between, you know, being famous, getting laid, or being in charge. And so our why needs to evolve, because our capabilities now are so strong. We need to have nicer and better motivations for playing with this media.
And in the metaverse, when we get tired of being whoever we are at that point, we just create another and give that one a shot.
Yeah. And, you know, I think the implications there, again, like, am I a virtual me in a conference room? Because this boring meeting is still very boring. But I like to think about the metaverse as like a life simulator, where there's such low stakes. You know, you can always die and start over in a video game. So why not live life where you can die and start over? And the metaverse has this opportunity to allow us to experience things we couldn't do in real life. Like, what does it feel like to donate $1 million to a cause that I care about and then be responsible for that? Like, that would be a very powerful metaverse experience. So I would advocate for using synthetic media to give us a chance to learn stuff you can't learn in reality, to make choices you don't have to live with, to be evil, to be good, to be kind, and to do all those things that we can't do in real life,
and potentially remove the fear that we have in real life.
Yeah, 100%. Take the foul shot, you know, in front of the crowd, and then it'll be a lot easier when you do it in reality. For sure.
That'd be great if you learned some lessons there and brought it into your real life, whichever one that is.
Simulated life. Yeah. Yeah. So Nathan, and you touched on this already, but how can culture influence the way we employ synthetic media?
Well, I can, and I have some links, which I'm happy to share, or you gentlemen can share on my behalf if it's easier. But I think that, like, as I said, Borat is a good example of, how it can be, shared. But I think that idea of shifting perspective for other people, is really powerful. So some examples of that are an event of moon disaster, which is an amazing deepfake experience, also an Emmy winner. And for those, I say this often, but if you're going to watch any award, I think Oscars, Cannes, whatever, the interactive documentary Emmy, I think is the place to, it's just such a cool, and as somebody who won that award, I'm also obviously big upping myself, but it's where we're really seeing a convergence of really interesting aspects of media. So an event of moon disaster imagines the Apollo 11 mission didn't go so well, and Nixon had to deliver the alternate speech, which was written, but he never delivered, and talking about that disaster. And it uses beautiful generative voice stuff and some deepfake to make it real, and allowing us to kind of practice that experience and think about the implications, not using our imaginations, not reading about it, not watching a TV show, but literally sitting in the driver's seat and saying, like, what if this happened? And that gives us an opportunity to think in ways about life that we can't. I think another cool example, and again, I'll post the links in the chat unless you gents want to do it, is Kendrick Lamar's Heart Part 5 video for his most recent album. You know, his work is so dense and layered and powerful and impactful that the music video has an opportunity to kind of convey something on a more base level. And so he uses deepfake to replace his face. And it's super low key. It's not like particularly exciting from a technology perspective, but what's exciting is trying to figure out who he becomes and why. And then you add in the song and you have this really interesting convergence of image and audio that really gives you this deeper context and understanding of what he's trying to convey. And I think it brings up an interesting point when we think about synthetic media. And this is, I don't remember exactly where I heard this, so I'm quoting somebody else. But there is this thing with media where the more complex it gets, the more rudimentary our communication, simply because a book is a very simple media, right? So you have to write about the way things smell. You have to write about the way the light touches your face. You have to create in the medium an immense amount of complexity to bring all this stuff to life. And then when you move to film, for example, you don't. It's a more complex medium. So the signal gets simpler, right? You just show it. And what happens is the way the light hits your face becomes a lot less interesting. And you take that to the internet, which is an incredibly complex medium, and we communicate in memes, right? The most reductive kind of form of communication that you can come up with. And I think when you think about that, there's an opportunity from a cultural perspective to mash up mediums, right? So like a really simple application of deepfake over a really complicated song can give you an opportunity to understand the song in a different way. So it doesn't necessarily have to just be about the tech. It can also be about the cool media mix. And I'll give just a couple other real quick examples of how culture can impact synthetic media, but made by the same studio that made the Heart Part 5 video is Sassy Justice, which is made by the South Park guys. And Sassy Justice is basically like the Borat of deepfake. And they were working on a feature, the pandemic hit. They didn't end up completing it, but you can watch the 11 minute or 15 minute pilot online. And it's about itself in many ways. It starts by talking about the power of deepfake to change the way we think. And then it uses deepfake to create this completely ridiculous South Park-y premise about a private detective named Sassy Justice, who happens to look exactly like Donald Trump. And all of these amazing celebrities show up, none of whom are actually participating. And it forces you to think about the power of the technology. It uses comedy to do it. So I think to kind of sum up, I think there's the opportunity for culture to be impacted by the technology simply by like that Kendrick thing of showing up as different people and making you wonder what it means and helping you understand another piece of media. He made the song, the video helps you understand it. That's a great use of synthetic media. With an event of moon disaster, you have the opportunity to an experience of reality that didn't exist in reality. So you can go through it and it's totally real. And now I can actually emotionally and cognitively be like, I'm playing make-believe in a really deep, immersive way. And then with Sassy Justice, I think the power of satire to help us kind of get perspective on the mediums itself, on the political state, on the cultural state, like so incredible to think about synthetic media as a device for satire.
That's a great idea. And lastly, last question for you today, aside from the audience questions, is how do we figure out how to use synthetic media as a creative partner as opposed to just a tool?
So I like to think about, rather than just the technology, Midjourney is a great example, right? People are posting all these Midjourney generative art pieces, and everybody's like, that looks so cool. It's making art. But really the interesting thing is the prompt that you used to get the generative art machine, right? But the thing is the prompts are boring. So Midjourney is this powerful thing to make stuff. Our prompts are our ability to kind of search and explore this digital intelligence to get it to make stuff. But like, where's the good part? And I think the good part is playing with it. The good part is like, stop posting the work. It's like, it's not yours and it's not good. It's like, it's the inevitable outcome of a machine trying to figure out what it's doing. But if you can say in the beginning, like, there's nothing good, just because it looks realer or it looks smoother, doesn't mean that it's necessarily good. Let us start these conversations with these technologies and try to figure out how to play with them. I worked at a large technology company known for its experiments with future forward technologies. And often people would make an experiment and be like, this AI is going to like, you know, blow your mind with its ability to like complete your idea or complete your drawing or like make music using computer vision. And it always sucked. Right? It was always a letdown. Everything that a technology does is ultimately a letdown because we want it to be, you know, it's like when you start a theater show and you're like, welcome to the best show you've ever seen. It's like, well, now you have 3 hours to like live up to that. If you start the show and you don't say it's the best show ever, then it can be the best show ever. If you start by saying it's the best show ever, it's not going to ever live up to that. And I think synthetic media suffers from the same problem because it's like, are you terrified of it? It's going to blow your mind. It's going to change the world. And it's like, cool, maybe not. Maybe it sucks right now. And maybe we don't yet know how to use it. Let's start playing with it. So where are the conversations about crafting prompts? And where's the wordle of creating prompts for digital generative art? Because that would be something great. Like, we were never trained on Google, we were never trained on our Alexa, we were never trained on our phone. Let's start onboarding people into synthetic media and generative art really slowly by saying, if you want to play with this stuff, you can't just join the beta. You have to prove that you have a point of view culturally that is worthwhile. So show us your prompts, explain to us why these are amazing. And if the prompts are amazing, then you can play with the tool, because maybe that'll result in something good. So in summary, thanks for listening to that rant. I think with synthetic media, we should think about onboarding and we should think about training and we should think about play dates, right? Don't necessarily jump right to outcomes, because we have to get good at it. And that takes a long time with these complicated machines.
Yeah. And I'm seeing some of that on some social media channels like LinkedIn, et cetera, where they share their prompts and like, look what I did when I asked for the when you say prompt, it's like the text to image or text to video type thing where you use tool X or tool Y to do that. And there's a number of them that are very democratized, very simple to use, to your point, but you still have to use your creativity to come up with the prompt, the block of text to say, this is what I'm looking for. Right. And I want iterations of this. Right. And I think we shared that some of that on previous episodes where we were using, you know, the OpenAI or whatever, or something from said company to do that. And it was pretty amazing to do that. You just keep typing, keep iterating that, mm-hmm. that text block, and it keeps iterating it. And you just say refresh, or add some more words or less words to clarify what you're looking for. And it keeps iterating. And then to your point around the best, sometimes we're not looking for the best because the best is too clean. And mm-hmm. what I've heard from some of the people in the voice space, synthetic voice space, is you need, in order to not sound like a robot, it has to have flaws.
Mm-hmm.
And the flaws can't just be like, every kind they say something, you have to say right? Because that would be too mechanical, right?
Right.
Or so, or you know, that kind of thing. Because that's what makes us sound human is the flaws. Mm-hmm. And so they literally, like when they have a virtual car created, they actually have to add dirt and fingerprints to it to make it look real. Otherwise, it looks like a video game.
Yeah.
Right. It's amazing how we want perfection, but we actually don't. We want it to be look real to a degree, right? And potentially better, to your point, if it is better, if it needs to be better, right? Or just different, right? Mm-hmm. Different lens, different perspective of what we're talking about. So this is awesome. Yeah. Thank you for bringing those perspectives today.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that you've all gotten the spam call where it's like the keyboard typing and then it's like, oh, hey, sorry, this is Diana. And then you get another one and it's like, oh, hey, sorry, this is Diana. And it's like, okay, you're not Diana, right? So don't try to make this good, like let it be bad. Because if a robocall started and it was like, this is a robotic spam call from a non-human, but I really appreciate it if you stayed. What would you do? You would totally stay on the phone because you'd be like, what's going to happen next? And it just can be that simple of just like really saying like, this is a machine and it's different and let's figure out how to do it. One, this is an experiment from that Originals, and Originals is a part of the company that just makes original work to play with stuff that clients aren't ready to buy yet. But version that as a generative text thing. We did a similar thing in execution with the immersive Van Gogh exhibit that's all over the planet right now, being a generative Van Gogh. But this one, what we did was try to figure out specifically how your words would change through the lens of somebody else. And we cast these virtual identities based on not just a diversity of lived experience, but also a diversity of writing styles and the context in which they were writing. And it's a really fun experiment to kind of play with and poke around. It's not particularly good at anything. Like the best thing to do is take like the lyrics of like a Journey song and just dump them in there for Prince. And it's like, it's always great, right? It's entertaining. But the overall concept is the thing, right? Not the execution. The overall concept that I want to say this in the style of Emily Dickinson or whatever. That's an interesting thought experiment that you don't really need to execute. But it's like, it's cool to think about it because that's on the way to coming up with something cool.
Absolutely. And to your point, that's how a lot of things have been synthesized is from one idea, one concept, potentially even a nefarious one, like Deep Tom Cruise, what was originally taken from the nefarious uses of synthetic media. And they're like, wait, I could do something really creative that actually puts a smile on people's face, right? And that's how that got created. So it's showing the concepts and potentially part of the process, right? Like back to the prompts and things like that. And jogging people's minds of like, wait, you can do that with this, but I could do this with this too, right? Mm-hmm. And then keep iterating to doing what you want to do, creatively speaking, or for whatever business purposes you have, right? But it starts with art, to your point, because if the artists embrace it and they can show people like the creativity and like, oh, wow, that's really inspiring. Wait, how do you do that, right? Back to your point, mm-hmm. it's the process, right? That journey. And then expanding on that journey. That's awesome. Yeah. So we have one, actually two other questions that came up. What are the positive aspects of being able to create synthetic identities online?
I think that, and I'll caveat everything I say about identity, by acknowledging my identity, but I think, the opportunity is kind of to show people maybe the way that you present, in a way that is authentic to you. You know, there's a great Susan Sontag essay called On Camp. And it talks about, you know, drag as being something that can exist in a bunch of different contexts. And I talk a lot about work drag. Like, I thought about my outfit for this, didn't nail it, don't feel great about it, but I dress in costume for clients, as we probably all do. I'm really intentional about it. But I think that idea of, being able to make costume that seems real is very powerful. And so you can take like the immense impact that drag culture, has had on mainstream culture and extend that into synthetic media and say, wow, what if we were all able to kind of manifest these costumes and just interact with them as if it was real life. And it goes far beyond like, oh, men are wearing makeup now, to, oh, everybody is just showing up as they feel, as opposed to like burdened by the reality of flesh and bones. And I think that's like a really exciting opportunity. I think it runs right up against the problem with the entire planet right now, which is the lack of protocol for identity on the internet, that you can be anybody anywhere, and the internet is optimized to bring out the worst in people. So I would propose that, you know, alongside the ability to manifest alternate identities, whether it's connected to the blockchain or whatever, there needs to be some sort of like, I'm doing this, but like, I'm still accountable for it, because identity can have huge impact on the way we interact and on how you impact other people's lives. And so I think people should feel a responsibility for that. A comic who's been canceled, so I won't mention his name just because I don't want to make anything too complicated, makes a really good point. He's wicked famous, he'll be fine. He's like, when you're little, you're in school and you call a kid fat, and then he cries and it makes you feel bad. But on the internet, you never see him cry. So you never learn that lesson that it makes you feel bad. So when it comes to synthetic identities, you have to be able to bring yourself to that too. If it's just dressing up in costumes and being able to like freak people out, then that's like the purge, that horror movie where it's like one night a year, everybody can do anything. Like, I don't want that for the future. And I don't think anybody else does too, but I love the idea that people could play and bring fiction into their reality in a way that makes them feel better.
Excellent. And again, another question. How do you think AI-generated platforms like Midjourney might affect the ways people express their synthetic identities?
Well, I think that's interesting. And I think I haven't seen it, but the new Cronenberg movie is about like kind of sculptural surgery and stuff like that. I think, you know, tattoos are really interesting now that everybody has them, because it's like, what are you trying to display? Like, what type of impact are you trying to have? But when you start to deal with something that allows you to manifest an alternate version of a truth, and working with like an AI generative platform, you could say like, today I feel like crap. I feel like, you know, I smell like cheese and everybody hates me. And then you could manifest that look. And it's like, when people are like, oh, you look amazing today, what's going on? And you're like, well, this is the costume I'm wearing today. It's a digital expression of this truth that I couldn't articulate, I could never actually express. And so again, the opportunity to maybe allow the AI to find a truth in its analysis that you can manifest as part of your identity, I think is really cool.
Awesome. I got a question. And it came up only recently, and you being on the agency side, Nathan, I'd like to hear your answer, is having to do with just the creative landscape in as a whole. What I've seen is resistance and lack of understanding. And I'm wondering what you feel we need to do, or what needs to happen to educate these creatives to start to embrace it and understand how it completely can serve them for the better.
Yeah, I mean, the as an agency, we created a capability called DumDum, which is a creative process, which ultimately is designed to kind of disempower and disable agency creatives from doing the stuff that they think they're good at. Because ultimately, I think we're at a point where, like, in the beginning, you were, let's say, like in broad, you're dealing with broadcast now. We're like post-print, you're dealing in broadcast in the agency world. And you have big ideas, right? You can think of anything conceptually, and then you're like, yes, that's an amazing idea. It's strategic, it's gonna do all this stuff, it's a hardworking ad. And then you make it as a TV ad. No one would ever question whether you were gonna make, how you're gonna make it, because it was always gonna be a TV ad. And then when digital marketing started happening, it was mostly like websites and hubs and like all of these like weird things that people had to do a lot of work to engage with. You had digital creatives who were often younger saying like, okay, my idea is a website where, and the old school creatives who came from TV would be like, that's not an idea, that's a website. Give me an idea. And the young creatives would be like, but it is an idea, right? And the old creators were like, no, it's not an idea. So there is this challenge between execution and idea. And now that all those digital creatives, myself included, are old, we've arrived at a moment where you can have those old fashioned conceptual thoughts and you don't know it's not going to be a TV ad. You don't know if it's going to be a TV ad or anything else, but you have to allow yourself to go into that space of, what is the true strategic manifestation of this? What is this big, wonderful world I'm going to build for this brand or this company? And then once you've crafted that, you can turn to your technologist or your producers and say, how are we going to do this? And, you know, your media people and those technologists can help solve the problem and bring it to life, because what used to be a TV ad is now real life. So we need to think about campaigns the way we thought about TV ads, but just with the understanding that we can bring them to life and make them immersive experiences. And that's very much how we work. And you can see in the work that we do in our website, that it's all very conceptual, but it's executed using every single toy and tool in existence. Our work recently for Long Drink, which is this very delicious Finnish alcohol beverage, we've got spots and we've got celebrities, mouse tellers in there. But we designed costumes that exist that are going to be made available so that you can actually start to dress up as a character in the show, in the video. And then your social videos are just like our videos. And the line gets blurred between the thing we made and the thing you made. And I think the same goes for AR, right? Giving people the tools to make their own content, blurring the line between what was created by the company and what was created by humans is a great way to approach it. And I'll just say that everybody doing great work on the internet, for the most part, doesn't exist in the agency space. And so a big thing to do would be to rethink what an agency creative is and who they are and where you found them.
Awesome.
Myself included. I'm all about getting myself fired or making it really hard for me to get a job.
A new challenge.
Yeah. Reinventing yourself again.
Yeah, let's do it.
About open data or scraped?
Can you say that one more time?
Open data or scraped?
Mm-hmm.
Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think broadly speaking, this is a hard question to answer, because I kind of like Jaron Lanier has a great line, which is he says, I don't believe in AI. And because AI isn't a monolithic thing. AI is always like a bunch of machine learning robots, and it's always in different shapes and sizes. And when we talk about the ethical or functional use of data, I feel very much the same way. Some of my favorite work that we made was for Signal, And part of the challenge was we couldn't buy any data, which means we couldn't make advertising. So it had to be organic. And it led to some super awesome work that impacted in a totally different way. And I think I would back it up even further and say, like, if you're using data to understand people, then you're doing it wrong. So stop doing that. People hate it.
Don't do that.
The worst. And then if you're scraping data, it depends on what your objectives are, right? If you want to berate somebody about shoes they already bought, then I think like scrape their data and hit them over and over again. If you want to find ways to start looking at distributing resources in the world, then I think open data is really important, because you're going to have to be able to look at people who aren't necessarily self-reporting their needs. But again, it totally depends on the context. And overall, I think just like to really have like a distributed internet, everyone would need their own server. To really have like a healthy data ecosystem, we'd have to start building very different data sets.
That's excellent. You look like you're chomping at the bit, Henrik. You got something to say?
No. I think this is great. Yeah. I'm just thinking of my next blog post.
There you go.
I think you just gave me the title for it. It's coming soon.
That's great.
Yeah.
Well, we want to respect everybody's time. So, Nathan, thank you so much for joining us today. Incredible insights.
Awesome. It was great chatting, and thanks for the questions. And appreciate the opportunity to share some thoughts.
I still believe that companies' success in the near future will be measured by how they balance the value of synthetic media. I mean, there's just no two ways about it. And you brought some great perspectives. Cool. So I'm sorry, what was that?
I just said right on. If anybody wants to, I'm on Twitter at Nathan Phillips. Not the Native American political activist, nor Samuel L. Jackson's co-star in Snakes on a Plane, nor the former mayor of Toronto who has a large square named after him. Just me at Nathan Phillips on all your favorite social media platforms.
Outstanding. We'll see you soon. And everybody, until the next installment, take care.
Thanks.
All right, have a good one.